Hello, I'm Will Stein, and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 Desert Island Disc series, whereby each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book, and luxury item they would want to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in the podcast. You can find links to the 8 songs on the LSE Geography and Environment website. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Geography Island Jams. Today I'm joined by one of the LSE Directorate, Andrew Young. Andrew joined the LSE in 2016 from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine as LSE's first Chief Operating Officer. Before starting his career in academic administration, Andrew completed an undergrad, a PhD, and 8 years of research in zoology and related areas. His move into academic administration started as the role of Department Manager in the Department of Agricultural and Environmental Science at Newcastle University. Eventually, Andrew became head of the Science, Agriculture and Engineering Faculty Office before becoming the COO of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Andrew has many responsibilities across the school. He is directly responsible for the majority of the central professional services, including estates, HR, IMT, communications, risk and compliance, EDI, ARD, residences and catering, and has oversight of the general administration of the school. Whilst Andrew is a proud South Londoner, he is originally from the north of England, as he was born in South Shields and then grew up in Sunderland from the age of 6 onwards. Outside of the LSE, Andrew is a man of many hobbies. Keeping with his zoology roots, Andrew is a keen gardener and has recently resumed taking macro photography of insects. In addition to being a green-fingered entomophile, Andrew is a royal supporter of the Sunderland football team, an admirer of old and original maps, as well as being a DIY fanatic. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Will.
So my first question I wanted to ask about your passion for DIY. So have you always been into building things, and what's the most recent project you've been working on?
Oh, good question. Well, yes, I have. I've always been quite good at taking things apart, and then I thought, really, I better learn how to put them together again. So over probably 25 years, I've watched people who know what, you know, who are qualified and know what they're doing and copied them. And So I will tackle pretty much anything, electrics, you know, pointing and brickwork, and a bit of joinery was always my passion. I did woodwork at school, and I really, you know, I find that so satisfying working with wood. It's really, really great, and it's just a really great hobby. So latest project is really preparation for having my kitchen completely refurbished. So that was held up by the lockdown. We were literally about to start taking a wall down when lockdown arrived. So fortunately, we hadn't just started. We were just about to start. So that was a piece of luck. So that's my latest project. Well, obviously, I've got a builder in to do that, but I'll be doing some of the strip out and
so on. So I think you mentioned it briefly, but did you have a favourite type or style of project? Like, is it furniture or fixing broken things?
It's actually, I really like building things. I've built the fitted wardrobes in my house and the fitted units in the living room, and I replaced a few bits of flooring and demolished a chimney breast, that sort of thing. So I don't know, I just like to, you know, improve things, and I like them to be, I like things to be finished properly, which is the advantage you have doing it personally over a builder, because the builders are great at coming in and getting a big job done. But I always like the skirting boards finished the way I like them finished. And builders often don't have the time to take that time just to finish things off. So I often find myself finishing off builders' jobs when they've taken all the tools and gone home.
You previously mentioned to me that you have a specific chisel, which means a great deal to you. Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, I do. As you pointed out, I'm born and bred in the Northeast. And I have a few kind of special tools, but there's one in particular, which is a 12-inch long bevel-edged 1-inch wide chisel, which used to belong to my great-grandfather, who was called Joe Davison, and he worked in silks with pit, and he was the pit joiner. They used to build doorways into the pit and so on and so forth, and I inherited his tools, which is quite a thing, actually, because I really love using that particular chisel. It's an absolutely amazing piece of metal. It sharpens up beautifully and holds a really good edge. It's absolutely terrifying that one day I'll split the handle or something like that, you know, because, I mean, these things happen. It's normal wear and tear, but this was actually the handle which has his. And as was common in those days, if you were a craftsman, you stamped all your tools with your name, and it has his name stamped on that very handle. So I'm very careful about when I use it, but for when I'm doing a job that needs some real precision or it needs a little bit of craft, that's the one I always turn to. And I think of my great-grandfather, Joe, who lived his entire life in Silkswith on the south side of Sunderland. So there you go.
So we're now moving on to the music. Can you now please tell me about the first song you're going to be taking with you?
Well, a bit cheesy. I do love a bit of 70s disco, but actually I really love this song. It's Waterloo by ABBA. And there's kind of a London connection there, because growing up in the Northeast, certainly in the 70s, it was a really big deal to come to London. And my first trip to London was in early 1974. And I was in a little single room at the back of a hotel in Piccadilly with, you know, steam coming out of the walls outside, and you could smell the kitchens downstairs and this sort of thing. And I turned the radio on the morning. It was this huge radio right next to the bed, what you might call a radiogram. It was about 3 foot square, basically, and a big knob that went clunk when you turned it on. And believe it or not, there was the news. ABBA have, you know, the Swedish group ABBA have won Eurovision Song Contest.
Wow.
So I absolutely associated with the excitement of being in London for the first time, and obviously, you know, that reflects to where I am currently. But it's a really joyous song as well, you know, and it's absolutely it takes me right back. I was 11 or 12 or something at the time, and it was really great. So I love hearing it. It's really good. I can't stand still.
So, Andrew, you've been the Chief Operating Officer of LSE since January 2016, meaning you've been at LSE for about 4.5 years now. To start, for those who aren't familiar with your role, can you just say a bit more about what you do around the LSE?
Well, it's a slight joke. Lots of people have heard me say this before. Everything's my fault. Everything that goes wrong is my fault. It's kind of true, but obviously, you know, what I do is, I mean, people will say, actually, I don't do anything. What I do is manage other people who do things. And that is pretty much what I spend most of my time doing is pointing people in the right direction, supporting people, helping them when we get the difficult ideas, helping shape the strategy of the organization. And the most important thing for me, though, is it's a real people job. It's working with people. And I've always said that, you know, if the people who work for you are happy, they'll do a great job. The most important thing you do is recruit good people, and we've got lots of good people at the LSE. And I spend most of my time keeping them happy, guiding them, thanking them, welcoming them when they arrive, and really working with people to try and get us all working together collectively. Obviously, I've got a lot of staff, and they don't all know each other, but I know most of the bosses of all of those staff. And one of the things that I try to do is to get them working together and understanding why each group are doing what they do, and helping us really understand, helping everybody understand what's going on right across the organisation as much as I can. Because I think it's very easy to end up in a little stovepipe somewhere. And I think possibly when I arrived, that we were suffering from that a little bit. There wasn't enough appreciation of the great work that everybody else is doing.
So am I right in believing it was you behind the clusters within departments?
Yes, it was. As you mentioned, I was a departmental manager. They called it something else in those days, but that's what I was when I did my first administrative job. And there was a lot of making it up as you go along. And being a departmental manager is a really, really responsible job, because you're the most senior administrator in your department. And if you haven't got good connectivity with other departments around you, you really are on your own. And I'm very aware that, you know, we in the centre are constantly asking departments to do things in a different way, do new things, and it's, you know, you're getting pressed by me or service leaders in the centre, but you're also getting pressed by your own head of department and your own faculty as well. And that means you're really in the middle and sometimes very much on your own. And I was very keen to bring clusters together to help the departmental managers get some mutual support. I mean, I have to say that one of my aims is to get those departments sharing more expertise posts, if possible, so that if they need half of a person doing X, the next department along, the most adjacent department, which is probably one of their cluster partners, maybe there's a bit of opportunity for sharing there and sharing good practice as well. So, you know, I think it's worked pretty well. I'm very happy with clusters, and yeah, so that was why I introduced them, and I think it's going well anyway.
Can you now tell me about the second song you'll be taking with you?
So as I grew up, my favourite band, the band I absolutely loved and adored, was Queen. And I could not have adored Freddie Mercury more than I still do. And he's an absolute star. I was incredibly shy as a boy, incredibly shy. I was still pretty shy until my mid-20s. And to see this man behave the way that Freddie Mercury did, I mean, on stage, I didn't know, you know, his antics off stage weren't quite as well-known as they are now. It wouldn't have made any difference, I have to say. But anyway, so I absolutely love Queen. Waited for every album to come out. I am absolutely hopeless at lyrics. I mean, I love music, but I really don't get lyrics. They don't click in my head. But I do remember spending quite a lot of the spare time at the end of my O-level exams, when I'd done all my answers to the best I could, you know, writing down the Queen lyrics to pass my time. Anyway, and the song I've picked, it was really, really difficult to pick a particular song, but the song I've picked is Love of My Life, because in a sense, that's where Freddie Mercury is for me. But it also has a lot of personal poignance. My rather sadly, we had a bereavement in the family. My brother lost his wife, and he chose, you know, obviously, you know, we grew up together. He chose this song to play at her funeral. And so it has a real poignancy now, you know, or 30 odd, maybe 40 years on from when it was written. And I absolutely love the song. And it really, Freddie Mercury's voice is fantastic on this song. And it's a very quiet, emotional song, and it really shows him off. And I love it.
Do you think there are any misconceptions students or staff that they get wrong of the directorate?
I think it's really good. I mean, obviously, I've been in a couple of directorates now, and I knew the one at Newcastle pretty well as well. Yeah, we're all human beings. We've generally done something for in a reasoned way, because there were a set of facts presented to us, and we make the best decision we can at the time. And I know it doesn't always seem like that. What on earth are those idiots doing? Why on earth would they have thought that was possibly going to be a good idea? I think that, you know, sometimes you have to make tough decisions you really don't want to make, but they need to be done. We've just taken 10% out of our non-pay spend for next year, just like that. And it's a bit painful. But we've had to do it. And you know, we didn't want to do that either. You know, we don't want to do lots of things, but we have to, because we have to look up to the organisation. And I think certainly I, and I'm sure the rest of SMC would agree, that we're only custodians of this thing that is the LSE, that has all of that, you know, immense history and this immense influence on the world. And we have to look after it. And one of the most important things that we're thinking about right at the moment, with the potential financial hit that we've started to take with the summer school, but we might take next term, we are very clear that there's a tremendous responsibility on us to look after the school long term, and there'll be some short term pain in the meantime. And you know, we don't want that to be any worse than it has to be, but you know, we face a difficult time.
Can you now tell me about the third song you'll be taking with you?
Yeah, so it's not so much a song, it's a tremendous piece of music. I'm a big fan of a lot of classical music as well, and I find it very soothing, and what I do like it about is it makes you think of something. It has an evocative nature. So, I mean, lots of people will know about The Lark Ascending and stuff like that, you know, classic FM's top song for years and years and years and so on. And Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto from a film. But the first one that I've included is Beethoven's Sixth, which is the Pastoral Symphony. And given my introduction, you'll know that the pastoral world is very dear to me, and agriculture and so on. And I was lucky enough to spend about 5.5 years working in the hills in Northumberland on an organic farm. And we'd split this heft into organic and conventional halves. I mean, and when I say split the heft, that's like a 3-mile long fence to do that. And we had over 100 quadrat sites on there, and every year I'd go up there with a 1 meter square quadrat, divide it into 100 squares and work out what was the dominant and subdominant plant species in each of those squares. So I used to sit up there, and at lunchtime I'd go back to the pickup I used to take up there and sit with my sandwiches and my orange juice and stick Classic FM on the radio. And it incredibly, on a day a bit like today when it is red hot and, you know, there's a little breeze blowing and the birds are singing, Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony came on, and I got to listen to the whole thing whilst watching the sun on the hills and listening to the birds and watching the insects fly and the grass grow, basically. And it was it was kind of a really important moment for me, because I realised just how lucky I was to be doing that sort of work. It was actually pretty tough work. I mean, it sounds idyllic, doesn't it? But actually bent over a quadrat for probably an hour at a time, you know, recording what you can see in each square and trying to work out, you know, balances of species and so on. It was pretty odd work, actually. And then I had to drive an hour back to Newcastle after that. So it was odd work, but gosh, the sound of Beethoven's Sixth takes me back straight away there every time. And the past, it's an absolutely beautiful piece of music. If you've not heard it, I really recommend you spend sort of 3/4 of an hour listening to it. It is absolutely astonishingly beautiful.
Well, that leads me quite well into the next set of questions. After finishing school, you went to do your undergrad degree in applied zoology at Reading.
Yeah.
Do you have any fond memories from your time at Reading?
Oh, lots. It was great. It was a fantastic degree to do. It was exactly what I wanted at the time. I thought I wanted to be a vet, but actually I realised that, I didn't get the exams that I had to be a vet. So I went and did zoology, and it was really, really interesting. It was a really, really interesting subject. One of the big advantages of Reading is because it is actually completely unlike LSE. It is a huge park. And I lived in a hall of residence on that park for my entire time there, and did my degree there. And of course, it was like living in a laboratory for me. You know, I saw my first wild snake there, and, you know, lots of bugs and owls and, you know, birds and so on. It was fantastic.
So after finishing your undergrad in applied zoology, you went to Newcastle to do a PhD in zoology, and then a further 8 years researching pest control in cereals, as well as organic farming in the Northumberland uplands. Can you tell me what you did your PhD in?
Yeah, I thought you'd ask that. I did my PhD working on slugs. At that time, I considered myself an agric, and they're an incredibly recalcitrant pest of cereals, and particularly the establishment of winter wheat, which of course is an enormously important crop. And in years where you have a mild, damp summer, they lay lots of eggs, and then we then strip all of the rest of the food from their environment and then plant these little nutritious seeds. And of course they go for the seeds, and they're a really big problem. So at the time we were trying to make slug pellets work better, and one of the most important things I did in my life was work on a way to predict when slugs become active. Because if they're not active, there's no point using slug pellets. And the slug pellets at the time were really, really toxic. And if you went into a field the following morning after application, you see lots of dead worms and beetles and so on. And it was actually a bit of an ecological disaster to use them. So if you should really use them as little as possible. So the work we did was to try and work out exactly the sort of conditions when they become active, so that you only put pellets out when slugs are active. And if they don't become active before the seeds have germinated and appeared above ground, you don't use slug pellets at all. And that was one of the things that we put into the mix of advice for farmers. I like to think it made a difference, but who knows. So, yeah, I worked on slugs. There you go. Secret's out.
Can you now tell me about the fourth song you'll be taking with you?
Okay, so you mentioned that I'm a keen Sunderland supporter. And from something like 1972 until about 2006, other than the time I was at Reading, I didn't miss a home game in all of that time. And I've been at something like 50 or 60 different away grounds following them. I have to say it's a labour of futility, and we're at the lowest ebb in the history of the football club at the moment. However, the best time ever at the football club was when Peter Reid was our manager, right just before the turn of the century. That makes me sound really old, doesn't it? So in the sort of 97 to about 2003 period, when we had the most fantastic team. Sunderland had the European Golden Boot winner 1 year. I mean, Kevin Phillips is a god as far as I'm concerned. And it was really fantastic. And importantly, we left the ground that Sunderland had been playing in for 99 years, Roker Park, and went to the new ground, the Stadium of Light, which was absolutely awesome. And it is an immense ground. And one of the things I like about it most, of course, is not just about, if it was the football, I probably would have given up a long time ago, but of course, is the friends that I used to meet year after year after year, only ever at the football match. We don't, you know, we didn't barely talk to each other outside the ground unless we were arranging to go away much. But we'd meet there and we'd talk about the same things as we did when we were 16. And except that, of course, the surroundings had changed. And one of the things that had changed most is the music they played when the football team come onto the pitch. Now, if you imagine something like 48,000 crazy Sunderland supporters at a big match, floodlights are on, the atmosphere is building, and just as the teams are ready to come out onto the pitch, they chose to play, for some reason, I don't know why, Dance of the Night from Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev, which is the most, you know, it's a really loud, impactful piece of music. It's really dramatic. And it just raises the temperature just before the teams are coming out. And I don't know, nobody decided this, but everybody stands up. It's a bit, you know, like that. Like another area that will be the, you know, when the national anthem comes on. And everybody stands up and everybody starts cheering and there's noises going on and the atmosphere is absolutely awesome. And there's something about, you know, the kind of the people of Sunderland, that sort of shared friendship thing that was going on there and the emotion of the whole thing and the fantastic team where we actually stood a chance of, you know, winning pretty much every game, actually. We did pretty well for two or three seasons in the middle of that period. And it was fabulous football, and it was a really great time to be a Sunderland supporter, and I don't suppose I'll ever see it again, but it's encapsulated by the Dance of the Night by Prokofiev. So there you go.
Fab. So you spent most of your childhood growing up in Sunderland. Is there anything you remember most prominently from that time?
You know, looking back, I had a very lucky childhood. You know, particular moment, I was out doing something. It might have been playing football in the churchyard across the road and getting chased by the vicar quite a lot, or going out on my bike and cycling around the area between South Shields and Sunderland, or spending a lot of time at the beach. You know, we lived two blocks from the sea. You could just about hear, on a rough day, you could just about hear the sea from our house, and I still love the smell of the sea when we go back. It's awesome. So the thing I remember pretty much is freedom. If I'd been a bit less free and did a little bit more work, I might have done slightly better in my exams. But it was a time when I was really free, and it was fabulous. I was very lucky in my childhood. I absolutely acknowledge that. You know, we weren't particularly wealthy, but I had lots of fresh air and some good friends, and we spent a lot of time outside.
Do you have any funny or mischievous stories from your time growing up?
I do actually. I have one. So my parents first lived in a house in South Shields, and it was a terraced house, and we had a little backyard. And in the backyard was a little kind of offshoot in the back of the house. And in my mischievous days, I used to climb up the bin store and get onto the roof of this offshoot at the back of the house and climb up to the top of it. So you got to about just a bit above first story height, but bear in mind I was actually 5 at the time. And, you know, we look back and say we used to make our own entertainment. Well, yeah, we used to take horrible risks as well. And I do remember thinking to myself, I must never do this in wellies. And one day I did do it in wellies, and the inevitable happened because it was wet, and I slid off the roof, bounced off the coal house floor and landed on my head. Now, that won't be a surprise to many of you who know me. That has a lasting effect, and I still have a scar on the back of my head. Anyway, so I'm sitting on the floor screaming, and my mother runs out. And, of course, I knew I wasn't supposed to do this. So I told her I'd fallen over. Anyway, off I went to hospital. I had 4 stitches in the back of my head. And years and years and years later, when we lived in Sunderland, there was just a conversation. And I said to my mother, that's like that time when I slid off the roof and bounced off the coal house and landed on my head. And I got a good hiding because one of the things I haven't got is a very good memory. So it's one of the lessons I have learned is probably try not to lie unless you absolutely have to, because I'm unlikely to remember it. So yeah, I got a clip around the ear for that, which I thoroughly, of course, deserved. Yeah.
And now, can you tell me about the first song you were taking with you?
I sort of dip in and out of popular music, and one of the bits that I'd missed really was the the kind of mid to late 80s. It just kind of passed me by for some reason. So my wife-to-be introduced me to a band called The Wedding Present. And her favourite song is My Favourite Dress. And I could not believe it when I heard it. It's absolutely awesome. Dave Gedge is the kind of lead man, and the rest of the band has changed around him over the years, but he must have been going 40 years now. And my wife's seen him, I don't know, probably 50 times. In the last 15 years, I've probably seen them a dozen times. Amazing band. They play lots of small venues, so you can really get up close and see the band and like, really experience it. And it's just fantastic. So that's My Favourite Dress by The Wedding Present. And well, you know, if you listen to the lyrics, it's got all those, a lot of stories going on there. But that's not probably reflective of the new relationship I was taking up. But it was really a brilliant song.
Do you have a dish which you most enjoy to cook?
If I may go for a generic dish, various forms of curry. I really like making curry. And my wife, as I say that, I know if my wife listens back to this, she'll take the mick out of me for saying curry. Well, that is how you pronounce curry. And it is, I really love it. I really love that sort of alchemy thing of getting fresh spices and mixing them up and grinding them and bringing it all together into something that people like to eat. And so curry, absolutely love it. Can't get enough. I'd have it every night. I'd have it for breakfast. Really, really good.
Can you now tell me about the sixth song you'll be taking with you?
The next one is One Bright Star by Paul Weller. And I saw him play this once in concert, and he described it as a crazed tango. And the reason why it's there is because Joe and I did it as our wedding dance. And I was determined that I wasn't going to just do the normal sort of shuffle at our wedding, and we'd do something, put a bit of effort in. None of you will have seen me dance, and none of you will, because I dance like some of me's in a different time zone. But we practiced in our living room, this tango, you know, taking chunks out of the walls with our heels and this sort of thing. And we did it, actually. I'm really proud of the fact that we actually did it. And there is a video out there somewhere. Again, no one will ever see it. But it is a reminder that actually I beat my demons and we managed to get some rhythm. I think my wife was horrified, really. I mean, I'm just utterly useless. But it was a great thing to do. And One Bright Star is also a lovely song as a wedding song as well. And Paul Weller writes some really good lyrics. It's very, very close to my heart.
So, of course, assuming after, you know, Corona's gone and all travel restrictions are taken away, is there anywhere in the world which you're most keen to travel to?
Oh, blimey. Yeah, there are two or three. So I'll just rattle them off. My daughter's in Canada. We have relatives in Canada. I'd love to go there. I've relatives in Greece and Spain as well, and but we go there reasonably often. I've been to Canada, and I'll probably return in a little while to the United States. I'm absolutely fascinated by the United States. It is, at the same time, the best of things and the worst of things, as we've recently seen. A lot of my musical influence comes from the States. That might not come over quite so much in the musical choices, but, you know, it was really difficult to miss out the Stones and a whole bunch of blues music. That I couldn't include, but I also have a real fascination for New Zealand. I'd really like to spend a bit of time in New Zealand. A really beautiful country, huge, wide open spaces, great nature, of course. And so I'm really quite fascinated that much more actually than I am by Australia. I think there's a bit of it. It's like a massive version of the UK with all of the people taken out of it, and it's, you know, it's retained its much more natural environment. Like I said earlier, I think we think of a lot of the UK being a natural environment. Most of it is a managed environment. To see the sort of wide open spaces, I think would be really interesting. One of my favourite things actually is I can't sleep at night. I use what's it called, Google Maps, to go touring around somewhere I've never been before. And the southern tip of South America, it actually is really good. There's quite a lot of coverage down there. And you could go through a lot of wide open spaces. Is it Ushuaia, the most southern city in the world? Anyway, take a look. I love going and looking at things like that. I'm just nosy.
Can you now tell me about the seventh song you'll be taking with you?
So I mentioned the States before. For my wife's specific birthday, with a number I won't mention, obviously, I took it to New York, and one or two things that fell into place, and there were a few surprises that we came up with. But one of them was this band from the northeast of England, who we both knew, and we've seen a couple of times. And by huge coincidence, they were playing in New York while we were there. So I got tickets, of course, and took her there. So early in the evening, just before we were going back to the hotel to get ready to go out, she didn't know where we were going, I turned around and said, look. And of course, her jaw dropped, and the band was Maxine Will Park. And the record is Apply Some Pressure, probably the most famous song, which is a bit of a lad's jump around if you can't dance sort of song, which is kind of my sort of thing, as I've described. And the most amazing thing is we met some people who were ex-students from Newcastle in the crowd there, because they recognised our accents. We've made friends, and we've been friends ever since. One of them, he was brought up in Newton Aycliffe, northeast of England, and she was brought up in the States. She came over as an exchange student for a year. They got together, got married, and now they're living in New York as primary school teachers, and we've been friends ever since. So this song is Apply Some Pressure, because it reminds me of developing that friendship and amazing coincidences that happen in life. That you could not, but I mean, I could not, you know, we just booked a holiday. I had no idea Maxine Will Park was going to be playing in the US. So we've seen in the Gramercy Theatre, I've seen one of my favourite bands, Maxine Will Park, play live. And better still, when they were at university with each other, they were also at university with the drummer from the band. And he stayed the previous night with them. So he came out to have a chat with them before the gig started. We got talking and I told them why we were there. And so they went off, came back to do the encore, and we got a massive shout out from Paul Smith, the lead singer. Happy ex-birthday to Joe. Great shout out to Andrew. Great present for this birthday. So we got the most amazing shout out as well. And then they launched into Apply Some Pressure. Incredible. You couldn't make it up. I promise I'm not making it up. It's true.
What's your favourite part of being at the LSE?
People. You know, it's a bit corny, isn't it? It's the people. It's just great fun. Most of the time, it's great fun. We all have different ambitions. You know, this is a really strong, world-leading organisation. We've got great people there. You know, sometimes it's incredible. You think, you'll have a hard time there. You go over there and tell them you've got to do that, Andrew, they'll take it a bit. You know, it'll just be a... You get there, people are really nice. You know, you just got to talk to each other more and explain more. My favourite bit is the people at the LSE. It is amazing. You know, people like yourself doing all of that social stuff for your department and prior to that for the geography students. And how sad is it that we haven't got this year's ball, the summer ball, you know, which was going to be fantastic. After all that time, you've been persuading me that we needed a summer ball. And we came up with it, and it would have been absolutely amazing. And it's amazing because of the people at the LSE. We've got some fabulous people, and it's great fun working with a vast majority of you. Sometimes it's a bit more challenging, but it's just great. I love it.
So just moving on to your eighth and final song.
Yeah.
What is it, and any reasons why?
So this is a bit of a departure. So most New Year's, we've ended up in my sister-in-law and her husband's house, which happily is a detached house in Northumberland. I say detached because the music's pretty loud and it goes on for a very long time. And we have a kind of a dance. We probably drink far more than we should do and have a really great time. And it's one of the highlights of the year, just having a real blowout at New Year. And one song I always gravitate back to is American Boy by Estelle, featuring, I think the term is, Kanye West. And I just love her voice. Her voice is so clear. And she sings. One of the things I really dislike is singers who just scream at you, right? Who's just singing so loud and so, I think the term is, powerfully, that it's just it all gets completely lost. She can sing really loud, really clearly, perfect pitch, absolutely, and it's just a great song. Got a great rhythm. It's lovely, and you know, I mentioned the US link, and so I wanted to have something, you know, it specifically says American Boy, but it really has a reference to wanting to go to the States and spend some time and so on, and that really resonates as well. So it reminds me of New Year's and the States and the big white space that is the US and the real kind of richness over there. You know, it's just a really great song. Really good. And I just love it. It makes me think of a party.
So just before I let you go, you're allowed to take with you the Bible, the beverage report, and a book of your choice. What is the book you'll be taking with you?
Book was probably, it started off being a difficult thing, then it was an easy one. It's Wisdom. Wisdom Cricketer's Almanac. When I was a kid, I used to, I love cricket. I love cricket. My whole family loves cricket. One of the things I used to do was manually record all of the England Test cricket scores. I used to write the whole lot down. And I've got two books, which are as big as my PhD thesis, covering 20 years of manually recording English Test cricket.
Wow.
Of course, you don't need to do it now because you can look them all up on the web in seconds. But it was a hobby of mine. And I love Wisdom because it's full of records and an account of the previous season and so on and so forth. Love it. And it really keeps you busy. There's about 1,500 pages in it, so it keeps you busy for a long time.
God,
so that's my
book. Will keep you busy, that's for sure.
It will.
And then finally, but by no means the least, what will be your luxury item?
My luxury item is very specific. I'd like a fully stocked cocktail cabinet with a bottomless supply of apple martini, because that'll help me watch the sun go down on my desert island whilst I nod off with the Wisdom in hand. So that's my happy place. It's definitely one of my happy places when we go on holiday, watching the sun go down. And so that's me set up. Apple martinis forever.
Brilliant. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for telling me about your Geography Island jams.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Will. Take care.